It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Snowboarder Nick Baumgartner of Iron River, Michigan, grew up miles from the Wisconsin border, and he's schooled in the roller coaster of emotions as a four-time Olympian, coming up short of the podium and then winning gold in mixed snowboard cross at the Beijing Olympic Games in 2022. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Baumgartner's new memoir is called Gold from Iron, A Humble Beginning, Olympic Dreams, and the Power in Getting Back Up. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Awesome. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
You dedicate the book to all the youpers and talk about being filled with youper grit when times get tough. What does it mean to be from the Upper Peninsula, the UP?
Well, it's an area that I cherish. I mean, we call it paradise, but it's just an amazing place. And people work a lot harder from there. I think that comes from just having to fight for all the opportunities. We have less opportunities than the big city kids do. And it just takes a little bit more. No one's going to give us an opportunity. We have to fight for that and we have to work for that. But I think that makes us stronger in the long run and it sets us up for success.
Is that why you call yourself a blue-collar Olympian? Can you explain that distinction?
So blue-collar Olympian is, it goes back to like, I had to fund this dream. I didn't come from a background that allowed me to have the funds to go out and go to academies and go to these training facilities to do this. I had to find a more creative way to do it. And my goal was always to be a professional snowboarder. And the definition of a professional snowboarder is someone who gets paid to snowboard. So I had to be a little more creative. I found a job in Wisconsin as a union concrete laborer. And that allowed me to work long hours all summer long, making tons, very good money for a young kid. And then when the winter months came and it got too cold to pour concrete, we were laid off and then we could draw unemployment. So with a little creativity, I was able to get paid to snowboard. And it made it better for me. It's my favorite part because I had to fight for it. If I didn't find a job and find a trade that allowed me to do this, it wouldn't have been possible for me.
You also have had to find sponsors along the way and for people to help fund you as well. And you have said that it feels like you have to really be a little bit of a sales pitch. Can you talk about that aspect of sponsorships and what it involves?
Yeah, you definitely have to be turned into a salesperson. And throughout my whole career, I've had to find creative ways to do that in the sense that snowboard cross, what we do, doesn't get a lot of support from the industry of snowboarding. So I had to find ways to find support outside of the industry. So for me, being from the Upper Peninsula, one of my number one sponsors is Ponzi, and they're a Finnish logging company with their North American headquarters in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And it's just because the number one industry where I live is logging. So I found someone that shared that same kind of stuff and that passion. And a lot of my friends and a lot of the people that I went to school with went on to start their own forestry and logging companies. And so that's how I was able to gain a relationship with these people. And they're just super passionate about being able to help me with what I'm doing. And they want to give me an opportunity. And it's been incredible. And I have another company, which is a hometown company, Crist Oil. They have gas stations throughout all of northern Wisconsin. And it's just finding people that that kind of share my same story and want to help and want to be a part of my legacy. And it's just finding that creativity and not being afraid to ask people. I think sometimes people are afraid to go out there and ask for things. And I've found that by asking people for stuff, I've gotten to do some pretty amazing things throughout my career. Things like racing trucks professionally all over the country, racing professionally in Mexico's Baja Peninsula. Gotten to do some cool things because I wasn't afraid to ask and to reach out to people.
We're talking with Olympic snowboarder Nick Baumgartner about his memoir, Gold from Iron. You can join in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Nick, your son Landon, born when you were 22, and you dedicate the book as well to him. Can you describe, does Landon travel with you now that he's older? How do you incorporate family into your dream?
Yeah, well, I think my dream doesn't happen at all without the birth of my son. I was 22 years old. I was a child myself, and I was immature. I didn't know what the world was about. And I was more focused about me and what I wanted and what I needed. And I think by having a son and making it bigger than myself, I needed to not only provide for this kid at this point, but I needed to lead by example and show him what's possible. If you're willing to dream big and you're willing to outwork everybody, and without that, I just don't know that I would have the longevity. I think I would have went into this with just the wrong attitude, and it wouldn't have worked out. So by having my son, it's been unbelievable. I haven't been able to travel with him a bunch to a lot of races, but my first race he got to come to was in 2011. He got to come out to the X Games, and I found out very fast that when he's on the bottom of the hill, I race way better. And I actually, right before he showed up, it was 12 days before the X Games, I was training in Copper Mountain, Colorado, and I crashed and I broke my collarbone. Mm. I had to get 15 screws and a plate put in 12 days before the race. And everyone counted me out and thought that, all right, there's no way this guy's going to be a threat. But they didn't know that my son was going to be at the bottom. And I went on and to win 12 days after surgery, to win the biggest race of my life at that point. And it all had to do with having my son at the bottom, and just no one was going to beat me to the bottom to my son. There's no chance.
There's so much grit in your story, and it makes me wonder about those young years growing up with three older brothers and how, you know, everything was a competition. How did the competitiveness between you and your siblings motivate you early on and then kind of touch you throughout your career?
Well, I think my brothers were extreme athletes in everything they did. They were so good and so successful that they set the bar so high on how to get that success. Hmm. by outworking people and by fighting for what you wanted. And it showed me how to act. But more importantly, I wanted to beat my older brothers in something at some point. They were so good. And when you fast forward to high school, their senior year of high school got the most athletic in their class, as well as the best defensive player on the football team. I didn't get either of those things. So it kind of put a chip on my shoulder, and it made me work harder and fight for something. I wanted to prove that I was better than them at something. And I think it took till I was 40, coming home with a gold medal in snowboarding, to prove that I was the best snowboarder in the family. So I finally accomplished that goal after many years of trying.
Your parents also had three strict rules for the kids to follow growing up. One was that chores were mandatory. What else did they really, you know, passionately instill in you in terms of rules of the house?
Well, definitely you had to work. It was funny. Anytime a family member, a friend of the family, or one of my parents' relatives needed help, whether it be tilling a field for the farm and picking rocks or baling hay, they were always like, "Oh man, you guys need help. I got kids. We'll send them over."
we were never
expected to get paid either. It was just to do the right thing, to help out our neighbors when they needed help. And it just instilled in us just that sense of helping out when we can, and that work ethic. And it's just, I'm very fortunate. We didn't grow up with a ton of money growing up, but we were rich in so many other aspects. My parents were foster care providers. My sister, we adopted when she was two and I was three. And just having all these kids in and out, just the lessons that we learned throughout all that. And my parents, man, I couldn't have grown up or asked for better parents than I had. And it's a big part of my success, just the way that they raised us and the way that they showed us that, like I said, chores were necessary. And if you weren't doing a sport, you had to get a job. So we were always fighting to get into the next sport, to the next sport. And to me, that's very important because, yeah. Yes, you learn a lot in the classroom, but the lessons that I learned on the athletic field or on the wrestling mat. Those lessons have helped me be successful in every aspect of my life. It teaches you about how to overcome adversity, how to deal with failure, and how to get back up when you get knocked down. And I think that's why you'll see so many lessons like that throughout my book. And every time I get knocked down, I get back up. And it was from those lessons that I learned in sport and through my family.
Nick Baumgartner is a snowboarding Olympic gold medalist. We explore his new memoir. It's called Gold from Iron. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn life lessons and how to chase a dream from a veteran Olympian snowboarder who proudly hails from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, minutes from the Wisconsin border. Nick Baumgartner's new memoir is called Gold from Iron, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick, we heard from Jack and Madison called in, and Jack says it's great for a blue-collar Midwesterner to make it in sports, and reminds Jack of the Milwaukee Bucks winning the NBA championships in 2021. What advice do you have for Midwesterners or anyone from that background, Jack wonders, who are aspiring for sports greatness?
I think don't believe the excuses. I mean, we can always come up in even in our own heads of excuses of why we don't have the opportunity to do this. One, we don't come from the right place. One, we're too old, or we don't have the funds to be able to make this happen. There's always a way. There's always a way. If you dig in hard enough and you're willing to outwork people, there's always a way to make it happen. And we get one chance at life. I mean, why not fight for it? If you do everything you can, I mean, if you do everything you can, that's possible to get what you want and you fall short, it's okay. You can live with that. You've done everything you can. There's no shame in that. But when you cut corners and you believe the excuses and you don't go out there and fight for what you want, and then you fall short, that'll haunt you for the rest of your life. So go out there and get what you want out of life.
You also recommend putting pen to paper and writing down your goals. Why do you suggest that?
Well, I mean, I've read books and I've seen lessons and I've listened to speakers, and they always say writing down your goals is so important, because just by writing it down and looking at it over and over again, you're 40% more likely to achieve that goal. There's nothing in life that will give you a free 40% that easily. Just by writing it down, you 40% more likely to succeed. Come on. I mean, that's so easy to just write it down, look at it, put it on your refrigerator, put it in your bathroom, put it places where you will see this. And you got a way better chance for sure.
Okay. So we're going to talk about a coach at Copper Mountain in Utah who really helped you make a change that catapulted your career. Can you explain how one coach helped you so much?
Yeah. So when I got into snowboarding, I'm from basically northern Wisconsin, but right across the border in the Upper Peninsula. And there was no like blueprint on how to do this. I didn't know any professional snowboarders from the area. I didn't know any mentors that I could ask and figure out how to do this. I kind of just ran into it like, here I am. I don't know what I'm doing, but here I am. And that was good, and it was great because I took a chance, but I did need some knowledge and I needed some coaching. And I had a coach, Nate Park. He definitely, he found a way to break it down to me and explain to me the things that I was doing wrong, or why these movements or these different things that I needed to learn, why I needed to learn them. And just by having it broke down and having someone really explain it to me so that in a manner that I could understand it, it was like a light bulb went off and I was like, oh, well, that's why I need to do that. And once I understood and once I figured out like what the reason was and it changed everything. Then I was willing to work harder for it. I was willing to do the right thing rather than just going out there and just doing something. I mean, that's a great way to start, to just go in there, but you got to learn how to figure it out. And surrounding yourself with people that know what's going on and how to do it is the best way to get that success faster.
It sounds like you also soak in information, especially about technique and other things. You just soak it in almost in an extremely active way. How do you acquire knowledge and then apply it as a snowboarder?
Well, for me, my biggest thing when I got into it, I had all the drive in the world and the passion. I wanted to win it. And I think that's like something sometimes you can't coach that. But when you can find someone that has that, you can teach them everything else. So for me, I wanted it so bad. And I, at first, before I had my coach, I didn't know like what to do. So what I did is I picked out the guys that were the best, that had already figured it out and knew what they were doing. And then I tried to emulate them. I was like, if I just do what they're doing, I'm going to get better. When I tried to do a turn, I wanted to look like a kid that ended up being my teammate for many years, Graham Watanabe, a three-time Olympian. I was like, this guy has the best form I've ever seen. If I can just try to look like that when I'm riding, it's going to be better. And I started to pick things up. And just by looking at the people that had already figured it out, asking questions, it's so important to find people that know how to do it and ask questions. But when you ask questions to people that really know what's going on, man, it short tracks everything and it gets you a little shortcut to the top. Obviously, there is no shortcuts. I shouldn't say shortcut because it's a bad word to use. There is no shortcuts. Hard work is always the answer. But by talking to people, you don't waste that energy. You're more efficient with what you're doing.
Team USA snowboarder Nick Baumgartner in conversation about his new memoir, Gold from Iron. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Nick, you meet who you call Mr. Swixguy and learn about waxing your boards. And I'm wondering first, you know, how many boards do you carry with you around the world?
When I travel now, so at this race, I have seven snowboards with me.
Seven race boards,
and then one free ride board. So when we're not on course and we're just having fun, because it's important for us to not just always do the sport in the training, and that you need to keep the love for it. So I make sure that I have a board that's fun to ride and just out there and having fun. But we have different boards for different conditions, different grinds on the base of our boards. That's a structure that they put on the bottom for different conditions. So yeah, we travel with a lot of boards and it does get difficult. But going back to what you said, the Swix guy, yeah, I showed up to a race again at the beginning. I just showed up not knowing what I was doing. And I showed up to this big race. It was my first televised race in Crested Butte, Colorado. And I see all these guys like rubbing stuff on their boards and doing all these things to the bottom of their board. And I was like, oh, crap. I have no idea what they're doing. And that looks very important. And luckily there was a guy from the company Swix that was, he was selling and pushing this paste that he had that they would put on the bottom. So I went up to him again to give myself a chance. And I asked him questions. I was like, hey man, what do you got there? And can I use some of that? And luckily he had these samples that he was giving people and he handed me some, and then he told me what to do. So I start working on my board, and then I get in the heat, and it's funny because all the people that were there, they're like, dude, you're in big trouble. You're racing against one, that guy right there won last year, that guy won the year before, and that guy next to him is his brother. So you're in big trouble. And I was like, oh, all right, well, here we go. I'm going to go do my best. And luckily the Swix guy gave me that sample stuff. And I went out there and I won that first heat. And when I got back to the top, he grabbed my board and he said, you are not touching this thing anymore. And then he went and started putting the stuff on that all these guys were putting on, the better stuff. And it just leveled the playing field. And it gave me an opportunity to be successful. Because without that, there's no chance that I would have been able to. My skill and my ability and my determination would not have been enough. I needed to have the same chance as everyone else. And luckily, this guy was willing to do it.
One other thing that has really taken snowboarding to the next level is technology and like drones looking at courses and what lines to follow. What new things are going on there?
So for us, we've always had this like technical advantage. We had a coach for many years that was just like a super nerd about this kind of stuff, about giving us that technical advantage. He actually invented a video system that allowed us as a team and no other team. I think the teams are slowly starting to get this now, but we've already had it for 15 years, where he would film from up on the edge of the mountain, way up high, so he could get the entire course. And as he's filming, as soon as he gets done, it goes through this Wi-Fi system. He sets up what looks like a little weather station. And the other teams are looking at him like he's crazy. They're like, what's that weather system? It was just a Wi-Fi system that would allow him to shoot that video from his camera, bounce it off of the Wi-Fi system, and throw it to iPads that were at the top of the course.
So you can exactly see what your teammates and other racers are doing. Talking about a new memoir from Nick Baumgartner on being an Olympian, what it's like. You can call in 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Olympic snowboarding gold medalist Nick Baumgartner pushes the limits on top of mountains. The Michigan native's new memoir, Gold from Iron, recounts his journey to four Olympics and the community in the Upper Peninsula who rally around him. You can join the conversation, call in with a question, share your views at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jean in Wales. Jean, hi, go ahead.
Hi. Hey, Nick, we're so proud of you. I'm a Uper from the UP, been there forever, and have followed your journey from the very, very beginning. So I'm on my sixth copy of your book that my family all wanted.
Oh, Jean, thank you so much for calling in. Nick, you can feel the warmth from Jean and so many others. You know, when you come back or came back from the Olympics, you had a huge parade that escorted you. You know, how was that parade and how was that reception?
It was unbelievable. So I landed into Green Bay, Wisconsin. I walked out and I just hear chants of USA, USA, the Olympic music playing in the background. And I walked out to just so many friends of mine that are from the Green Bay area. And then my son surprised me. So I got to see him, hug, lots of tears, lots of high fives. And then we stayed the night there so that I could come into town the next day. And my favorite thing was being able to drive through these community. I think Pembine, Wisconsin was the first one that had people spread out throughout the town. And then Niagara, and then we crossed into Michigan, and then through Iron Mountain back into Florence, Wisconsin, and all the way home. And just seeing so many people willing to stand out in the freezing cold and cheering for us. But being able to have my son there made it so special. And just to, I mean, there was a lot of tears happening. And then when we got to Iron River, it was crazy. There was people from all over the Midwest that had driven up to be a part of that parade. And rather than drive through the town, I decided to get out and walk and be able to walk over and hug people. And anytime I saw someone that even had a little bit to do with my journey, the tears would start flowing and the hugs would happen. Mm. And that's why, I mean, it's someone like Jean that makes me so proud to represent these people. It's just amazing people that when you do something good and you're from a small community, everyone will rally behind you. And it's been the story of my journey for sure.
Let's pick up on the tears, because you gave dozens of speeches after winning the gold at age 40, and you shed tears in front of your audiences. I'm wondering how you deal with emotions and the raw emotions you feel, whether it's right after a race in front of news cameras or in front of your audiences in the UP.
It's just one thing I can say is ever since I represented not only my country, my family, but my whole community back in the Midwest, at the first Olympics in 2010, when I walked out into opening ceremonies, it changed me as a human being. I went from thinking I was this young, tough guy to a very emotional. And now if I go and watch like kids' sporting events and I see like whatever age it is, maybe even an 8-year-old make a basket, everyone's cheering and having a good time. And I'm in the corner crying. And it's brought out those emotions in me. And I think it's very important. Emotions are good. And to be able to share them as this masculine athlete is, I think it's important for people to see that. And it's not like a trick or anything. I just, when I start talking about my story and the things I've gotten to do and fighting through those challenges to get to that point where I finally won that medal, the tears just come out naturally. And I'm happy to share it. I'm not embarrassed by it in any way, shape or form. I think it's important. Yeah, sometimes I can't finish my sentences, which is, makes it a little tough to do a speech, but it's awesome. And I think it's that raw and that honest emotion that people want to see and people should see.
I want to explore how you found the Upper Peninsula a really perfect training ground for an Olympian, you know, physically and mentally. You know, you write about how Dustin Brancheaux popped into your life. Can you talk about that training and what you did in the UP?
So, like I mentioned before, the Upper Peninsula, we don't have the same opportunities as everyone else. You go to these big cities, and they have these sports specific training facilities with just the top of the line. The technology, everything is there for you to be successful. And we don't have that all over the Upper Peninsula. And to be honest, the only place I could find that was in Marquette, Michigan. And I was very fortunate that Dustin Brancheaux at Advantage Sports Training in Marquette reached out to me and he said, "Hey, I think we can help you with your training." And I was like, "All right, here's a guy, a fellow Youper that really wants to be a part of this." And not only that, but he was a football player. He's a collegiate football player who was trying to make it to the NFL. And that was my first dream. I went to college to play football. Unfortunately, found out that I was too immature for college and I needed to take a break. And that's when I switched to the snowboarding. But this guy understood me and he got me. And by going up there and training with him, at 40 years old, you can't just do the same old stuff you were doing. You got to be more efficient in what you're doing. So with his program, I was able to be efficient. And if, say, I showed up and I was tired, we had technology and we had eyes and computers reading the speed at which I was pushing the weights. So if I was tired and exhausted, I just didn't do it because I needed to do another set. We knew when, all right, you're tired, you need to take a break. We need to change this and do something different. And that was the first time that I experienced that when I was back home in the UP. And it was, I think it was crucial to my success at the Olympics.
Meanwhile, living out of your van with your dog Oakley, why did you decide to do that?
So, I mean, when we say a blue-collar Olympian, I needed to find a way to not have to pour concrete all summer long because, one, I needed to be able to train more. And when you're working 12-hour days, it's hard to fit it in. And then I'm beating the crap out of my body, my hands, my back. I was just hurting myself. So I needed to find a way. So my brother's a contractor out in Aspen, Colorado. So I went out there and I worked for him for a month in the spring. And that made me enough money to not have to work all summer long. But I didn't have money to go up to Marquette and spend $200 a night staying in a hotel. So I had this van that I used for construction and I just slid a bed into the back and we parked it anywhere we could find a place to do it because I saved so much money being able to do that. By staying in the van, I wasn't spending $600 to $800 a week in hotel rooms. I was just spending the gas money going up and it just made it so much more feasible. And then I would go straight from the gym to the mountain bike trails. And I think people don't understand that. I mean, I've been all over the world and I've mountain biked at a lot of places. And the mountain bike trails that we have in the Upper Peninsula are world class. And it was important for me because mountain biking is the closest thing I can get to what I do on sport. So it's the best cross training I can do. And by going up and staying the night in Marquette and working out 4 days a week, it gave me that opportunity to just set myself up for the closest training and the closest replication to what I do on the snow.
I smiled when you jump into Lake Superior at the end of a hard day working out.
Right. I mean, Lake Superior is freezing cold and people talk about, oh, it's so cold. How do you go swimming? But Lake Superior will heal you if you jump into that cold water. And it's very important. And I think now you see so many people starting to do these cold plunges. Well, that's the biggest cold plunge in the world.
Team USA snowboarder Nick Baumgartner, our guide to the Olympics, What It Takes, new memoir, Gold from Iron. And you can join in with questions, 800-642-1234. Okay, Nick, truck racing, what the heck got into you? What was this period where you went into truck racing?
So it's funny, like I started racing snowboards because of people like Sean Palmer and seeing these other athletes, these extreme athletes doing these amazing things. And for me, lots of people would say, oh, these guys are lucky. They're on TV. They get to do this cool stuff, like Travis Pastrana, Brian Deegan, all these guys. And it was just funny. A lot of them, they made their name in one sport. And then they use that fame to cross over into rally racing. So when I got started into snowboarding, the goal was always to make a name for myself and cross over into auto sports. Well, fortunately, one of the biggest off-road truck racing tracks in the world is in Crandon, Wisconsin. And I had a friend who started racing trucks and asked me to come there and to be the voice in his ear, telling him what was going on around him. And it got me one step closer to that seat, that driver's seat. And I was like, I need to do this. And again, I just went out and I started asking people. And I asked people, and to my surprise, I started getting yeses. And I was able to race Pro Lights in the, I can't remember what it is now, but it's the Traxxas Torque Series when I was doing it. And I got to race against these guys that paved the way for me and gave me the blueprint, like Brian Deegan, Travis Pastrana. And I got to go out there and do that. And for me, it was a way for me to live on that edge, because when I'm racing snowboards, if it's crazy and things are happening around me, you got to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. And being able to stay at that, bouncing off that rev limiter and just going full speed all the time, I thought that it was going to give me this big advantage. So it was important for me to be able to do that. Plus, it was fun. It was like the craziest thing you've ever done, just pushing on that gas pedal and going as hard as you can. But it allowed me to race all year round, keeping those skills in that, all those skills just sharp and ready to go. So when I got back, all my competitors hadn't raced since the last season. Well, I've been racing all summer, so let's go. I'm ready.
And you had a major rollover, and just the dangers of that sport. Did that at all impact your snowboarding?
No, and I think you learn that, like when I crash on a snowboard, you get hurt. I broke my back. I broke my collarbone. Mm. I've had some injuries along the way. But in a race truck, you have this thing that's engineered and designed to keep you safe. Yes, accidents can happen and you can get injured. But I've rolled over in trucks. Like, we rolled over in Mexico in the Baja Peninsula. Mm-hmm. I was a passenger at this point. At 80 miles an hour, I rolled 5 times off the freeway. And when we came to a rest, I was like, I'm fine. This is crazy. It was hard to believe. But there's a saying that they say, with age comes the cage, because you can't take those hits as much. And when I'm on a snowboard, I've found a way to be a little bit better at calculating my risks and not just taking risks just to take them. So I don't crash as much as I used to. But in a race truck, I had all this stuff to protect me. But it was so fun. It was like the coolest thing I've ever gotten to do. And I think when people read this book, they're going to be blown away with the things that I got to do just because I wasn't afraid to ask.
Nick Baumgartner, Olympic gold medalist in snowboarding from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan near the Wisconsin border. New memoir tracing this journey of learning to snowboard as a teenager and then setting his sights on the Olympics, getting there multiple times. Call in with a question. Add your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're in conversation with Olympic snowboarder Nick Baumgartner about his new memoir, tracing his journey from a small community in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to top the podium at the Beijing Olympic Games. And there's space to talk. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Susie in Hartford is here. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Kate. I love your show. Nick, it's been so fun to watch your journey. I can't wait to read your book. All I can say is Niner would be so proud of all the things you're keeping doing. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Nick, that must feel so good to you. Can you talk about where your journey goes from here?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been very fortunate to have such a long career, but I've always said, as long as I'm having fun and I'm competitive, which kind of go hand in hand, I'm going to continue to do this as long as I can. And now everyone's like, well, why didn't you quit when you were on top? And I was like, well, now there's no pressure. I have the medal. So now I can just have fun and that pressure goes away. And I think when you're just having fun and there's no pressure, you become very dangerous. And even at 44 years old, I think that I have an opportunity to show up. Yes, I'm not going to be super fast at every single track, but when that track suits me and the things line up in my favor, you better watch out. Do not count me out, because I'm coming for you. And the fact that I'm still fast and I'm still having fun, it's just, for me, it's like I got plenty of time to get old and to not be able to do this. So if there's even a chance that I can continue to do this, I'm going to do it. And then that journey is going to head towards the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milano Cortina. My mom's family is all from a small village in northern Italy, and they really want me to be able to, or want to be able to go there. And so I guess there is a little bit of pressure. All my aunts and uncles and my cousins are like, we want to go, so you got to go. And I'm just having fun, and that's what life's about, having as much fun as you can. And like I said, I've been very fortunate to be able to do this, and I'm just going to keep doing it, because not only is it fun, but it still gives me those dreams and those goals, to set goals and to keep fighting for it and to push my body to see what I'm capable of.
And you're the veteran snowboarder out there. You've seen it all. You've seen so much. And the young snowboarders, they're watching you and looking up to you as that role model for the sport. You know, what do you want the sport to achieve next? Where do you see snowboarding going, and what can you do to propel it there?
Well, my biggest thing that I love about being the veteran and the mentor to these younger kids is, it's funny, for the U.S. snowboard team, I think it's very important to have a guy like me on the team, because one, like, these younger kids are coming to steal my job. So I work so hard and I make so many sacrifices, because the last thing I want to do is show up and look old. And I think a lot of people, as we're aging, can understand where I'm coming from. But on the other side of that, these kids are seeing that I'm pushing that and I'm staying fast. So they're out there pushing themselves and putting in the work, maybe more than they would have with not, because they don't want to lose to somebody that's as old as their parents. That's like not supposed to happen. So if they do, they push me, but then in return, I push them so much harder. And I think it's bringing, one, our team to another level. But I think it crosses across to everybody. No one wants to lose to an older guy, especially someone that's the same age as their parents. So we push this level, and snowboarding is such an amazing sport to me. Some people, we get a bad name, we get a bad rap. People think we're the troublemakers, we're the rebels. But we found this sport and we wanted to do it because it's cool, because it's our own thing. And to see how far it's come, every time I look at freestyle snowboarding, the half pipe, slope style, I think, like, it can't get any bigger than this. And now people are doing three flips and a half pipe and landing. And every time I think that, can we push this further? We find a way to push it further and to see what's possible. And it's just so cool to watch it, but it's even cooler to have been a part of it for so many years and to push the sport to the levels that it's at.
Another veteran in Lindsay Giacobellis, you winning the gold in 2022 with her. And you write about that friendship, like she's your sister. How did it feel to win that gold together?
Yeah, having a teammate makes it, I think, a lot more special. I would have loved to win the individual one, but I made a mistake and I had to own that. But when you bring a teammate into the thing, and especially for me being partnered with Lindsay, who is the greatest female snowboard cross racer of all time, it takes a little bit of pressure off because I'm pushing as hard as I can because I don't want to let her down. But if I do make a mistake, I've got the goat to make up for it. So it just, it allows some of that pressure to come off, but it also makes it more special because we're doing this together. She's giving everything she have to make sure that I'm successful, and I'm doing everything I can to make sure that she's successful. So it brings our level of riding to another level. And it's so special to be able to do it together. And for her to be 36 years old and for me to be 40, and to beat the bronze medal went to a 20 and a 22 year old. I mean, that, come on, a 42 year old to a 76 year old combined age, it's crazy. And it was super special. And I think we made a statement at that Olympics.
I want to land on the danger because you discuss snowboarding tracks that you felt were too dangerous for people to ride, especially at Sochi. Why are people allowed to compete on such dangerous tracks?
I think it goes back to just people need to trust the people that are actually risking their lives. We're out there doing everything we can to put on a show, but to push ourselves to be successful in what we're doing. But if we say it's not safe, you need to believe us, and you need to put in the work to make sure that it's safe. Like, we don't want it like super safe. We understand the risk going in. That's what makes our sport so cool. So we don't want it to be easy and have no risk, but we don't want any just ignorant, unsafe things. Like, we want it to be like, I love jumping at the X Games. When I won, we were jumping 130 feet. At 60 miles an hour, which is crazy to most people, but we train for that. And we know that risk when we go in. But it's when we see a problem with a course and they don't listen to us that makes it frustrating. And we've found ways since then. It's like anything, mistakes were made. But we've learned from those mistakes, and now they find ways to listen to us better, to have a communication with the athletes, to the builders, to the coaches, to the organizers. And unfortunately, some lessons need to be learned the hard way. And I think that goes back to my book. Like, I'm so proud of this book and the fact that there's so many young athletes out there that, yes, when you learn things the hard way, it sticks better, and you learn it and it really sticks. But you shouldn't have to learn everything the hard way. Some of us have already done that for you. And so you can read about it and learn and go, okay, all right, he did this and he learned from it. Maybe I don't have to do that.
Oh, Nick, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your journey.
Well, I appreciate it, you guys. And I know I always talk about being so proud and being from the Upper Peninsula, but I live 7 miles from the Wisconsin border.
You have the Wisconsin love as well. Yes. Nick Baumgartner, new memoir, Gold from Iron. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As a new generation of obesity medications emerges, we learn about injections to help people who are struggling with diabetes and chronic weight issues. You can be part of this discussion on weight loss drugs and health. Call in with a question, share comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Don Belt Davis is a UW Health endocrinologist and professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Davis, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
There is the stigma about obesity, and I think we should talk about it first. How much do physicians understand what causes obesity?
Well, I think, you know, we understand that there are many, many factors that go into the cause of obesity. But I think maybe the most important message to send is that it's not necessarily something that's always personal responsibility, which I think is a common misconception of the public that, you know, everyone with obesity is, you know, has personal responsibility. In other words, they made poor choices. What we know about obesity biologically is that it can be people can be predisposed to obesity based on events in their early life, even things that happened in utero before they were even born, exposures to various environmental impacts, as well as, you know, societal infrastructure, which makes it difficult for a lot of people to have access to healthy food and activity.
How does obesity then become life-threatening?
Well, obesity is in and of itself is, you know, may seem to be mostly a cosmetic issue, but in reality, individuals with obesity have a lot of underlying metabolic changes and are also have a lot of inflammatory processes going on in their body. And so we know that many people with obesity are at greatly increased risk of other diseases like diabetes, cardiovascular disease or heart attack, strokes, and even certain types of cancers as well.
Our state's health agency says about 2 in every 3 adults in the state are affected by excess weight. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, reports the national obesity rate has increased about 10 percentage points over the past 2 decades. Why is obesity becoming more common in this country?
Well, that's a really great question. Again, I think we have a lot of potential answers, but I'm not sure that there's just one easy answer to that question. You know, we think that increasing rates of obesity have a lot to do with, again, as I was mentioning, some societal changes that have happened. You know, people have more access to kind of low nutritional quality but high calorie foods. There's probably less access to activity in people's general day. People spend a lot more of their working day nowadays sitting in front of a computer rather than doing any sort of physical work. So a lot of factors have really gone into this. As I mentioned, a lot of these are societal more than individual factors. And it's a huge problem, as you mentioned. You know, this overweight and obesity affects almost 2/3 of our population. So I think as we talk about the impact that we'll have in the future on our overall health, but also kind of our societal impact on the cost of medical care in this world, in the country in particular, it's really going to be something that we're really struggling with. So, you know, we kind of refer to obesity as, you know, a really important public health issue that is going to have a huge impact across the next several decades.
Dr. Don Belt-Davis with us, UW Health endocrinologist and UW-Madison professor of medicine. As we explore new treatments for obesity, you can join in with your questions and comments at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Davis, how are the treatment options for obesity changing?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of kind of new and interest, I guess, in obesity treatment and a lot of, I guess, media attention and sort of public awareness of some newer medication therapies for obesity. I'm sure we'll get into the details on those. But we have had, you know, various treatments for obesity for, you know, many years. We have used medications for the treatment of obesity, and we've also used bariatric surgery, which can be a very effective way to treat obesity as well. But this newer class of medications that we'll most likely talk about today are injectables. These include a medication called semaglutide, which is marketed as Ozempic for the treatment of diabetes, and that is marketed as Wegovy for the treatment of obesity. And then there are other drugs in that same class that are also works in a similar way. And I think these have received a lot of attention because they're a bit newer. They are more effective than some of the older medications we had for obesity management, and they've just been popular on social media and other things that has really gained them a lot of attention.
physicians as well, scientists calling it, you know, game changers, a transformational time in the conversation around Ozempic and Wegovy. How miraculous are these drugs?
Well, I think I would not call them miraculous. I think that, you know, is a bit of an overstatement. And I think that's a little bit where a lot of the public misconception can sometimes come in. So these medications in the treatment of obesity specifically, not in patients who also have diabetes, but specifically for the treatment of obesity, these medications can, they can promote a meaningful amount of weight loss. And by meaningful, I'm kind of focusing on clinically meaningful. So on average, you know, patients might lose somewhere in the range of, 10 to 30 pounds of weight on these medications, which is good. And that often can lead to significant improvement in their overall metabolic health, maybe lower their risk of diabetes or improve their diabetes. But it also isn't a miracle drug. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is not the medication that's going to allow someone to lose 100 pounds, 150 pounds, and completely kind of transform their life. But it can be a very helpful tool. So I think it's just important to kind of understand the capacity. There's also variable responses. Some people seem to respond very well to these medications and maybe lose more than 30 pounds, but others don't have a really strong response and maybe they only lose a smaller amount of weight.
Okay, so we got the clinical meaningful weight loss there, but what is the pharmacological aspect of this? How do these drugs work in the body?
Sure. So the drugs we're talking about here, which again, the one that most people have heard of is semaglutide, which is known as Ozempic or Wegovy, but there are drugs in this class, including something called Victoza, Trulicity, Saxenda. These are all in the same class. And what they do is they are essentially designed to mimic a hormone that our body makes normally. This hormone is called GLP-1. And GLP-1 is a hormone that we normally make every time we eat. It's secreted from endocrine cells in the gut in response to food. And it sort of signals to your body, hey, I just ate something. Get ready to process all these nutrients coming in and get ready to stop eating because you just ate and you don't need to eat anymore. So it sends signals to the brain that you're to help you feel full and to reduce appetite. It sends signals to the nerves that control the stomach to kind of delay the emptying of the stomach and help you feel full a little bit longer. And it also sends signals to parts of the body that help you process those nutrients, like the beta cells in the pancreas that secrete insulin and helps you secrete more insulin and move that blood sugar down. And that's why it also works for diabetes as well.
And
go ahead.
And these are working through injections. Is that right?
Correct. Because it's a hormone, a peptide hormone, it's not something that can be taken orally in general. However, there is an oral version of semaglutide available now. The brand name there is Rybelsus. That's been around for a few years now. I think it was approved in about 2019. And that does work through the same pathways, and it can be taken as a pill.
Dr. Don Belt-Davis, endocrinologist, directs the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center as we explore the changing treatment landscape for weight loss drugs. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how obesity treatments could change with medications that are associated with diabetes management and ones that are currently being investigated as potential anti-obesity drugs. You can join in the conversation about achieving and maintaining weight loss. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Don Belt-Davis is a UW health endocrinologist, directs the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center. Let's take a call now. Lori is joining us from Milwaukee. Lori, hi. Go ahead. What is your story?
Hi. Good morning. I pretty much have been an advocate for these weight loss drugs by experience. I'm above 60, tried for about 2 years, everything, intermittent fasting, smoothies, you name it. I tried for 2 years, so I'm postmenopausal, and I just kept chunking on the weight, 2 to 4 pounds a month at some points. So I finally convinced my doctor and went through all the paces, went on Ozempic, had a fine experience, titrated correctly per my doctor. She's awesome. Then insurance switched me to Wegovy. That went well. Then I stopped working and didn't have insurance, so then I flew solo. Now I'm going to ask for another alternative that I can afford. I just want to be an advocate for people who would like to try it, because we're hearing so many terrible things, and I got such attitude from relatives, coworkers, everyone when it was so politically incorrect to use it. It truly saved my body and my brain. I now swim, I walk, I can move better, I can exercise what I need to exercise. Knees and hips are improved, but not amazing. So I'm calling to encourage people to check with their doctor, go through the paces, don't hear the 1% terrible, and then ask you, what's the next most affordable step you could consider for my continued weight management?
Lori, thank you so much for sharing your story. Dr. Davis.
Hi. Yeah, thank you so much for calling in, Lori. And I think, you know, your experience is what we hear quite commonly. Like I was saying earlier, these drugs can be quite effective at helping patients, you know, lose weight when they, you know, struggled and failed. And a lot of the older medications and therapies we had for weight loss just were not as effective. But you bring up a really good point, which is that, unfortunately, what we suspect and what we know probably is that these medications, once you discontinue them, then often people likely will regain weight off of these medications. And they are also very expensive, as you point out. And some patients don't have insurance coverage options for these. Even if they have insurance, some companies don't cover these medications for obesity. And if you lose insurance, obviously, then it can be completely unaffordable. So, you know, to kind of get at your question of what next. So when these medications are not available for whatever reason, cost, or there's also been a lot of supply chain issues and drug shortages with these medications, what do we do? And really, we don't have good answers there. I think there are not necessarily any other, you know, affordable ways to get these medications. There have been reports of a lot of people obtaining semaglutide from compounding pharmacies, for example, which I do not recommend. Those are not FDA regulated and are not, in fact, as far as I know, they're not legal. They're not allowed to make that medication off patent. So I would discourage people from doing that, buying a kind of compounded version of this that's not the formally approved version.
Do the drug companies themselves have particular programs for people who do not have coverage, like some type of application program that could help with assistance?
Sometimes they do, but for the most part, the answer is no there. For the vast majority of patients, they may be able to get a month or two supply, for example, like from a co-payment card or something like that, but eventually that will run out. Like there's no way to continue on these drugs somewhat indefinitely without being able to cover them with insurance or payment.
Laura in Green Bay called saying that they are diabetic, was prescribed Ozempic, worked well, Laura says, but now can't find the drug for diabetes, but their friend can buy it for weight loss. And Laura's wondering if they would have better luck getting it for weight loss as well.
Yeah, so this is exactly kind of what I was getting at. There's been a lot of shortages and a lot of supply chain issues. So, you know, these drugs have really exploded in popularity over the last, you know, couple years. And, you know, unfortunately, the companies just haven't been able to keep up with the demand. And so, this is happening to a lot of my patients as well with diabetes, that they are not able to get some of these medications. Sometimes there's an option to switch to one of the other medications in the same class. For example, Ozempic might be unavailable, but Trulicity might be available, or one of the other options. And so that's an important thing to ask your doctor and your pharmacist about. The weight loss version of semaglutide, which is Wegovy, also sometimes has been available when the diabetes version, Ozempic, is not. And so that's another way some patients have been able to obtain supply, is by getting it under the weight loss branded application. But again, it gets tricky with insurance, because insurance companies may not cover it for obesity therapy, but only cover it for diabetes, for example. So it can be very hard. And it's a lot of paperwork and phone calls and tracking down supply for patients and for the providers who are trying to prescribe these medications.
Dr. Don Bell Davis directs the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center. We're at the intersection of diabetes and weight loss and new medications coming to market. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Dr. Davis, are there some common side effects with Ozempic or Wegovy?
Yeah, the most common side effect, which is quite common, happens probably to 30 to 40% of patients taking these medications, is nausea. And that happens most commonly right at the onset of treatment. It often gets better, but not for everyone. And then some patients also, along with that, will have more severe GI upset, like vomiting, diarrhea, even constipation. And that's really the major side effect. There has been some, again, talk about these more rare side effects, things like trouble with emptying of the stomach causing problems, or other kind of rare side effects. And I think, as the previous caller mentioned, those are uncommon and rare. And so that's not the major thing. What we really worry about is just patients not being able to tolerate these medications because they have so much nausea.
In recent decades, though, some weight loss drugs have turned out to be dangerous. Drugs with amphetamines were addictive, others damaged heart valves. Are there reasons to be wary of the new weight loss drugs coming to market?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And you're right. And some of the older drugs, like, were based off of amphetamines, and some of the still approved drugs that we have for weight loss outside of this class can still have some side effects. They're much safer than the older versions. I think it's a great question, and time will tell to some regard in terms of whether there's any like longer term side effects, but these drugs aren't that new. We've had drugs in this class dating back for over 15 years now. So we've been using them for a long time for diabetes therapy. And they've been studied in very large clinical trials for many years. And we haven't seen a lot of short-term, side effects. But long-term effects, there's some concern about potentially increasing the risk of things like pancreatic cancer, increasing the risk of pancreatitis, which is an inflammation of the pancreas, and potentially some other things. But for the most part, we don't have any strong evidence to support that in the trials that have been done so far. And again, we'll have to just follow patients on these medications for longer periods of time to ensure there's no real signal there.
Longer periods of time, about how long would a patient stay on Ozempic or Wegovy for treatment of obesity?
Right. So that's really kind of coming back to our first caller's issue. The right answer to that is essentially as long as they want to maintain that weight loss. So, which could be forever, right? Mm. So we're talking about a medication that a patient would potentially need to continue taking somewhat indefinitely. And as long as they want to maintain that weight loss, weight regain can certainly happen with discontinuation of these medications. And so this isn't something that we recommend using for, short-term use to help lose a little bit of weight and then just go ahead and stop it. Now, again, there's variability. Some people are able to make lifestyle changes and other modifications and they can maintain the weight loss. But
and we have to pause right there. UW Health endocrinologist Don Bell Davis, our guide. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Newly approved weight loss medications are aimed at people struggling with obesity. We learn how this newer class of drugs used to treat diabetes is gaining attention for impressive weight loss results. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Don Belt-Davis is a UW Health endocrinologist and professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Davis, we heard from Val in Bayview, called in wondering to what degree these weight loss medications act as placebos. Do they initially motivate a person to lose weight through diet and exercise? And if so, do the drugs become less necessary so the dosages could be reduced and eventually eliminated over time? Dr. Davis, are you there?
Oh, I apologize.
That's
I forgot to mute myself.
Sure.
That's a great question. There certainly are some placebo effects that we see in, weight loss clinical trials. However, these drugs were all studied compared to a placebo group. So in other words, we know that they promote more weight loss even than what we would, the small amount we would see from that placebo effect. And the placebo effect is essentially just, a patient kind of paying more attention and being aware of their, their weight as part of a trial and maybe losing a little bit of weight on their own. The answer is yes, there are some patients who probably are able to use this opportunity to lose some weight with medication, change their lifestyle, be more active now because they've lost that weight and they're feeling better and they're healthier. And they can perhaps maintain that weight loss off of medication. But when we kind of look at averages across the board, that's not going to likely be the case. The case is most likely patients will have rebound weight gain. And that happens with almost every weight loss medication we have, that patients unfortunately tend to have rebound weight gain. The body sort of has this tricky way of resetting itself, and it unfortunately likes to kind of bring its weight back up to where it was. So it will actually change metabolism and things when you lose weight, and can sort of promote that weight regain in ways that are not so beneficial for the management of obesity.
If a person is prescribed one of the new weight loss therapies, are other therapies or nutritional guidance recommended alongside them?
Yeah, we always recommend, working on what we generically refer to as lifestyle modification, trying to follow a overall lower calorie diet and, get more activity in your day. Those are two things that we know can help promote both not so much weight loss, but also just overall health. So we do recommend those. But in terms of following a very specific diet, people talk about intermittent fasting and ketogenic diets and all those things. Those can be effective for weight loss, but we don't necessarily recommend those for patients taking these medications at the same time. But there's nothing wrong with continuing on a diet plan while you use these medications.
Heard from Samantha in Whitehall, who called in to say they're 42 years old, they're 5 feet tall, 180 pounds, and Samantha wants to know what they can do to eliminate the food cravings when they're not actually hungry.
Right. So, appetite suppression is one of the mechanisms that these drugs that we're talking about work through, but there are other medications, as I mentioned, as well. We use medications called phentermine and topiramate that can work pretty well as appetite suppressants and can also help promote weight loss in that way. And those can sometimes be a little more affordable than these newer injectable medications, but they also can have some other side effects as well. So suppressing appetite for some people is really critical to help them with that weight loss journey.
And it may be hard to understand or relate to what it's like not to feel full, not to recognize when the body doesn't need more nutrients. How can you describe that complication for someone who can't relate?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, sort of the things that drive people to eat are complicated. Mm-hmm. you know, for some patients, it's a very strong hunger feeling that they can have, which is disproportionate to the actual reality of when they've last eaten. And that is all regulated in the brain. Their brain secretes different hormones and, you know, neural outputs that make you feel hungry. And that can be very dysregulated in the setting of obesity. But on the other side, some people also have, you know, eating, dysregulated eating for other reasons. They may not necessarily feel hungry, but it's a way that they manage stress, the way that they kind of cope with difficult times during their day. It may be a way that they manage anxiety. And so it can be complicated in that way. And then there's also a lot of disordered eating, things like binge eating and other eating disorders that can play into all these challenges that patients have with weight gain and weight loss.
We're talking about advancements in weight loss treatments. Dr. Don Belt-Davis, UW Health endocrinologist and UW-Madison professor of medicine. You can join in questions and comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Marty in Lake Geneva with a question. Hi, Marty.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I heard that these diabetic drugs have been around for 15 years. I'm going to show my ignorance here. People that have diabetes, do they have to take these drugs for the rest of their life? Much like, you know, people who want to keep the weight off? And I'll listen to the response off air.
Marty, thank you so much. Dr. Davis.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the answer is basically yes. I mean, we have a lot of different medication options for the management of type 2 diabetes. So, you know, using a medication in this class is just one of the options. A patient may continue with a medication in this class, or for whatever reason, they may switch to a different medication. But yes, diabetes is a chronic disease. And so when a patient's diagnosed, they're going to need to continue to stay on some medical therapy for their diabetes typically. If they are able to lose a significant amount of weight, though, that's what we were getting at earlier, like metabolically significant weight loss. Some patients early in their diagnosis of diabetes are potentially able to, quote unquote, reverse their diabetes through significant weight loss, which could include using one of these medications. So it's possible, but again, then if they regain weight, they have to closely monitor for that return of their diabetes.
At what point should someone consider bariatric surgery?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up, because I think bariatric surgery also remains a really important component of our strategy for managing both diabetes and obesity, actually. Bariatric surgery can be highly effective at weight loss, and it promotes sustained weight loss. So this is an example where you can have the surgery and then the weight loss continues even beyond the surgery without ongoing treatment. Bariatric surgery is very helpful for diabetes. It can actually even reverse diabetes in some cases. So what bariatric surgery is recommended for people who have significant obesity. We typically would say a BMI at least greater than 35, and often with at least one other obesity-related disease like diabetes, hypertension, and again, it can be very effective, but it needs to be done in the right patient, and it is, you know, obviously a more invasive thing, although they have more and more advances in bariatric surgery also to make that a less invasive surgery with less long-term complications and side effects as well.
Can you walk us through what happens in bariatric surgery?
Sure. So, there's a few different forms of bariatric surgery. Currently, one of the most commonly performed ones now is called the sleeve gastrectomy, which is basically removing about 2/3 of the stomach. And by reducing the amount of volume, basically, for the stomach, there are some effects on just the patient feeling full more quickly. But interestingly, bariatric surgery seems to have a lot more effects than just the basic, you know, how much food can you eat at once? And it changes lots of different pathways in the body. It changes the hormones that are secreted after you eat. It changes the way that the gut processes food. And all of those changes are really critical for why bariatric surgery works. One of the hormones it changes is actually GLP-1, which is the hormone that these medications are designed to mimic. So basically these medications are mimicking one of the pathways that is effective for bariatric surgery.
So it has a more wider effect on the body's systems and how it mm-hmm. processes nutrients.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How effective is bariatric surgery in helping maintain a healthy weight? What has the research shown over the decades?
Yeah, so bariatric surgery can be quite effective in terms of weight loss overall. This is an example where patients actually can occasionally lose up to 100 pounds or more with bariatric surgery. And what we also know is that weight loss, as I mentioned earlier, is sustained. So there's been studies looking at patients who've had bariatric surgery 10, 15 years ago and their weight loss. Although they may regain a little bit of weight, they still maintain a weight that is significantly below their baseline before surgery. So it's both more effective, I would say, than the current medications we have. And it's also sustainable over the long term, which is very different than what we think is going to be the case. Now, we don't have 10 to 15 year data on patients who've lost weight with these drugs and then stopped them, but we predict that that most likely is not going to be as favorable.
And you said that the surgery is less invasive now. In what way? What have the advancements been like?
So the current one I just mentioned, sleeve gastrectomy, is removing part of the stomach, and that can be done laparoscopically. And previously, the more common one was called Roux-en-Y gastric bypass surgery, which involved more changes. The parts of the small intestine were removed and rerouted, and there was a little bit higher complication rate with that, and it was a little more invasive. And some of the older versions of bariatric surgery were even more invasive and more prone to malabsorption and other chronic nutritional problems as well. So there have been a lot of advances, and there's even some newer procedures that are under investigation now that are even less invasive, mm-hmm. potentially than just going in endoscopically, like to put in things through the mouth into the GI tract.
Dr. Don Belt-Davis, UW Health Endocrinologist, Director of the UW-Madison Comprehensive Diabetes Center, as we explore new weight loss therapies. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss an emerging class of medications that could help with weight loss in people who live with obesity and potentially treat other medical issues. UW Health endocrinologist Don Belt-Davis takes your questions about prescription injections associated with weight loss and diabetes management. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Davis, physicians and researchers have found that drugs like Ozempic might also be useful in treating addictions like compulsive shopping, smoking, and alcoholism. What potential do you see for these drugs to be used in treating other addictions?
Yeah, there's some interesting research coming out in that space, and there's, you know, also been some ongoing work looking at the potential role of these medications in other disorders associated with the brain. So I think, you know, it's a little early to say, but I agree there is some interesting early data. Importantly, I would say these drugs are not FDA approved for that use, and there hasn't been enough studies to formally kind of definitively say that it's going to be effective there. But I think it's something that we will definitely be watching over time, and there may be an even more expanded use of these medications. The one thing that we didn't really bring up is that these medications also do have other benefits in terms of reducing cardiovascular risk and also some improvements in overall kidney function for our patients with diabetes. So those potential benefits, again, may be there for the patient using this simply for obesity management as well.
Donna in Madison called in wondering why it is that when you reduce the amount of food you eat, your weight loss can stagnate and you don't lose the weight.
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, it is the reality. And I think this is why it can be really frustrating to try to lose weight. And it's also really frustrating, I think, to convey to certain people that, you know, it's not all about just willpower. As I mentioned earlier, you know, what we know happens with obesity is that there's kind of a reset and rewiring of a lot of the metabolic pathways in the body that really make it hard to lose weight. And when you do lose weight, if you reduce calorie intake, sometimes what the body does is it starts saying, oh my gosh, I'm not getting enough calories. So now I'm going to reset everything and I'm going to hold on to those calories even more.
Conserve. Yeah,
exactly. And so it just sort of creates this vicious cycle where it's really, really challenging to, you know, lose weight. And that's really what I'm getting at. Like, obesity is really, it's a disease process and it's a change in the way your body's responding to nutrients and your environment. And it really makes it difficult. It's not just a matter of like willpower to combat this problem.
And, you know, patients might say, look, I've tried everything that I can do to achieve a healthy lifestyle and reach that ideal healthy weight, and just nothing is working for me. I'm wondering how those conversations go as that patient has that situation where they have tried, you know, willpower and other things in their life to be able to take off the weight. What are your responses like?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's important to you know, reassure and validate people in that who are having those experiences, because as I mentioned, you know, role, and I think people have a lot of, you know, shame and blame and guilt and other feelings associated with obesity and weight loss. And it can be really challenging to kind of work through all of that and, you know, help them have a healthier lifestyle. I think, you know, as a society too, we often equate body weight with lots of things. And, you know, it's important to remember that for some people, maybe losing weight isn't as important as they might think. You know, if patients are only 10 to 15 pounds overweight and otherwise healthy and don't have any, you know, metabolic consequences of that extra weight, then, you know, maybe the better thing for them, for their mental health, is to essentially stay where they are. And I think we have this, you know, societal push that everyone needs to be at sort of this perfect body weight, which is really not possible and not sustainable for a lot of people.
There has been buildup, and I hate to use the word hype, but maybe it is that word, about these new emerging weight loss medications. Is there a strategy you use when talking with patients about, you know, what is practical and what is, you know, realistic for weight loss management, especially patients who have been reading up on these new medications and seem really eager to try?
Right. And I think, you know, again, it for me as a physician, what I'm really looking at is, you know, what are the overall health consequences of this excess weight? If a patient is having a lot of, you know, implications on their health related to the excess weight, they have early prediabetes, they have high blood pressure, they're having a lot of arthritis due to that excess weight. Those things, I think, are things that drive me to say, okay, there's a really strong medical need for us to help you with promoting weight loss, and I think we should move forward with this. But I think it's important to just remind everyone that, you know, there are always side effects with every medication we use. There's cost both to the individual and to society with every medication we use. And so I think we do have to think about this in terms of which patients are going to get the most benefit and make sure that it's kind of being used for patients with the most need, essentially, so that we aren't kind of bankrupting the system, I guess, by putting 66% of the population on these very expensive medications.
What other weight loss drugs are being developed that could be effective for treating obesity? What could be coming down the pipeline?
Yeah, so there's a new medication that was approved about a year ago for diabetes. It's the brand name there is Mounjaro. It's also the generic is tirzepatide. And there's pretty positive data on that medication for weight loss as well, and we expect it will be approved for weight loss alone in the very near future. And that drug seems to be even more powerful and potent than the ones we're talking about now. It works by targeting not just GLP-1, but also mimics another gut hormone called GIP, and targets both of those receptors. And so it's kind of even has like double potency. And so we're kind of excited about that one. That's the one that some people are referring to as kind of game changing, because the weight loss we get there at the maximum doses is getting close to what we can achieve with bariatric surgery.
Generics in this industry, in this area, is there any generic medicine?
So at this point, there is not. And as I mentioned, there are some compounding pharmacies selling these medications, which is not essentially legal. Mm-hmm. And even if some of these medications will be coming off patent or maybe already are off patent, but unfortunately, even with generics, sometimes that doesn't necessarily reduce the overall price, because pricing is a complicated thing and it's tied to demand and all these other things. So the pricing may not come down a lot even once we have a generic option.
In our last few moments together, Dr. Davis, is this an exciting time to be in the field you're in medicine? Is it changing?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we continue to learn more and more about how obesity works, how these metabolic pathways work. And I think there's a lot of new directions that things can go in. And it's really just exciting that we now do have medical options to offer patients that are effective and safe, and we can use them to really help people on that journey to try to improve their health and manage their obesity.
Dr. Davis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was great.
Dr. Don Belt Davis is a UW Health endocrinologist and professor of medicine in the Division of Endocrinology, Diabetes, and Metabolism at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.